Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Daniel R. Foley, Alexa D. M. Fujise, and Catherine G. Leonard presiding. Please be seated. Case number CAP 13314, consolidated with CAP 12-1065, Lanai Intersensible Growth versus Lanai Resorts LLC et al. Linda Lee Farm for appellant, David Copper for appellee. Argument on the merits.
Ms. Farm, ready to proceed?
Good morning. May it please the court, Linda Lee Farm on behalf of the Lanai Resorts LLC. We are here today in response to a request by Lanaians for Sensible Growth for oral argument in this case. This court is familiar with this case, having heard a previous appeal, so I will not spend a lot of time going into the factual background of this case. We are now here on appeal of the Circuit Court's 2012 order vacating the LUC's 2010 order and remanding it back to the LUC. At the outset, Lanai Resorts feels obliged to point out that contrary to the representation in LSG's request for retention for oral argument, the instant case is not concerned Native Hawaiian rights. We do this to avoid any confusion that may have resulted from that filing. I just wanted to make that clear. When this case was remanded in 2004 to the Circuit Court, the Supreme Court's instructions on remand were for clarification of findings or for further hearings if necessary on the issue of whether the petitioner used potable water from the high-level aquifer in violation of Condition 10. In addition, that same 2004 Supreme Court decision stated an administrative agency such as the LUC has the responsibility of stating with ascertainable certainty what it meant by the conditions it has imposed. Following the remand before the LUC vacated the 1996 cease and desist order and granted the modification of Condition 10 pursuant to the motions filed by Lanai Resorts, the Office of Planning, with some modifications. Now, before us today, the LSG takes the position that there were violations of due process, primarily because of the fact that one of their experts, Mr. Meyer, a hydrologist, was not allowed to testify live before the LUC.
Was there other testimony that LSG was allowed to present? I mean, I think that there's, excuse me, but it seems like there's two tracks here that we really have to narrow in on. One is, were there due process rights violated at the hearing on the remand? And I think the modification issues is key, but somewhat separate, arguably. So, I mean, some people were able to put on evidence and some people weren't. That seems problematic, doesn't it?
It does seem problematic if you just look at it superficially, but it is not problematic if you delve into the facts. And I agree with Your Honor that you need to look at it separately. There is the hearings that happened with respect to the taking of testimony. Those started in 2006. Now, at the outset, both sides agreed that they actually filed motions for no hearings, that the LUC could summarily.
But we got past that.
So here we have evidence. And then you started on with respect to the hearings. Yes, with respect, if you take a look at the record, and the record is indeed voluminous, you will see that the other parties were allowed to present their evidence. LSG did not have the opportunity at those hearings, because of the lack of time, to present the live testimony of its expert, Mr. Meyer. There were attempts to get him to testify later, but his expert report, which was Exhibit 6, although not admitted into evidence, was in the record. It was available.
Would that satisfy you if that happened to your client, that the other side got to submit live testimony and your client did not? Would you be happy with that?
Well, it would depend on the facts of the circumstances.
You would have no problem with that?
No, I am not saying that, Your Honor.
In Mauna Kea, which is supplemental, it says not only the reality but the appearance Is the appearance fair when one side is allowed to offer evidence and the other side not?
Well, Mauna Kea is distinguishable in several respects. And here, both sides agreed that the record was sufficient. Also, in Mauna Kea, they issued the permit before having the contested case hearing. Here, that's not the case. Here, they started the hearing. There's actually
not talking about the permit, talking about the appearance of fairness. And Justice Recknerwald's opinion, he compares it to a trial in terms of the appearance of fairness, not just fairness, but the appearance. And I don't see how you can actually argue that one side submits live testimony and the other doesn't, is the appearance of fairness.
Your Honor, I do agree with the fact that it may not look that, but if you look at what was actually in the record and the fact that the report and all of the testimony, the substance of what Mr. Myers had to
but
say.
But Alliance for Sensible Growth made it very clear in the record they wanted to submit live testimony and were prohibited from doing so.
But it's the timing that didn't allow it to do so. And then what I'd like to do is I'd like to move, because it's, well, it is.
The timing allowed your side to testify, but not their side.
Correct, but there were other opportunities.
All right, let me ask you a different question, if you don't mind. Maybe this will help. Assume, just arguendo, that there was a problem with not letting Linnaeans for Sensible Growth put on their evidence, that this court might be inclined to think that that was problematic. What happens in light of the modification? Okay, so say we say that was error. Now what happens?
Now what happens is that you can look at the separate procedural action of the modification.
And was it filed as a separate action?
It was within the same case number. It was within the same action. It was a bit later in the action. As a matter of fact, what happened is you had the hearing in 2006, in June 2006. Then they were filing subsequently for the respect to the modification. Then there was an opportunity with respect for the modification for all sides to put in whatever evidence.
But I think it would be helpful to the court, and I'm sorry for interrupting you, but this would be helpful to the court, because I think the problem here potentially is the Supreme Court's mandate on remand, and I won't try and paraphrase it because I'll probably get it wrong, but they said do this, this, and this. And modify condition 10 wasn't on the list. So the question is, was the modification motion properly before the agency in that proceeding? I mean, what is the authority for that? Because I think that's very key to your argument on the modification.
Yes, the modification proceeding was properly before the LUC. The LUC has the ability under HAR section 151594 to modify its conditions for good cause. And then the next question then becomes, was there good cause shown with respect to this? What you have is a situation in which the...
Before you get into that, you know, I've read the rules of the commission. I see that. It's very clear. But we have a wrinkle here that's not dealt with in the rules of the commission, and that's a mandate of the state Supreme Court sending it back to the circuit court to send it back to the Land Use Commission. And the mandate is solely for the Land Use Commission to clarify its findings of fact and conclusions of law or conduct further hearings if necessary. The commission decided to conduct further hearings. It was all part of the contested case hearing. When they entertained the motion for modification, that was outside the scope of the mandate.
No, Your Honor, it was not. It was their attempt for clarification.
Clarification of what?
Clarification as to what was expected. What was that?
It was to change the very condition that was the subject of the hearing.
I'm sorry.
It was to change condition number 10. It was to modify condition number 10. That was not within the mandate. The mandate was to clarify findings of fact, conclusions of law, in terms of a violation of the existing condition number 10, not to change it.
But the modification fell within the scope of the clarification, because what you have in this situation
Clarification of findings, not clarification of the condition. Clarification of the findings why the condition was violated, not to change the condition.
But what happened below on, in front of the LUC is they spent a lot of time trying to determine what potable meant. That was the central issue. And they couldn't get over the threshold issue on the definition of what potable meant. The Supreme Court even noted in its opinion in Note 8, it just simply was not clear. Now, you have an LUC that is struggling with what in 2006, that's struggling with the 1991 or 1996 LUC thought with respect to potable. They couldn't do that. They reached a point where, regardless of the information that was coming before it, and Mr. Meyer's information did not go to that issue as to what the LUC thought potable meant. There was no ability for them to do a clarification of the finding without reaching that threshold issue as to what is potable. What are they to do in that situation? They are then left with the correct thing to do, which is to make it ascertainably certain as to what that condition meant.
Changing the condition.
They modified the condition.
And was that within the mandate to modify the condition?
Yes, it was within the mandate
Where?
To modify the condition.
I don't see it.
With respect to the clarification, that issue was actually briefed. The LUC asked for briefing on that issue. They received briefing on the propriety of the modification.
Now, I know what the commission did, but I'm talking about the mandate of the state Supreme Court. I don't think modification, you know, if before it went to the Supreme Court, if before there was a mandate vacating it, had Lanai Resorts moved to modify condition number 10 under the rules, clearly they had the right to make that motion. The wrinkle is this mandate, and I see it outside the mandate. I just don't see you modifying a condition under the mandate. You know, otherwise, what good is a mandate from my court or the state Supreme Court if the agency can decide, well, we don't like the vacate, we're just going to change the rules. We're going to consider something else.
But there was a frustration of purpose with respect to the mandate. There was an inability for them to clarify. They took further hearings. They took information. At that point, they then decided to do the modification. They were unable to do anything else. Quite frankly, what would they do at that point?
Well, that question is something I'd like you to answer. And let me turn it around a little bit. Assuming that Judge Foley is correct, and or the, his question to you correctly states that the mandate does not incorporate modification. Assuming that is a correct premise, does that invalidate the modification, or can the modification stand even if we don't conclude that it's within the mandate?
The modification should stand even though it's not included in the mandate. The Supreme Court did not...
But that's the crux of it. So you're saying it should, but what is the legal basis for it? For the LUC to do it when that wasn't within the mandate?
Because the LUC always had the ability to do the modification. The Supreme Court did not say do not modify. It was within the LUC's provenance under...
Well, the Supreme Court implicitly said do not modify, do this or that, and that was not within that.
Well, when they took the further hearings, it became apparent that they couldn't clarify because they didn't understand or they had no basis for saying what potable meant. There was no way to make a determination as to whether or not there had been a violation, because you need to know what potable
meant. Well, maybe if they allowed Mr. Meyer's testimony, they would have had a better idea what potable meant.
Well, in looking at Mr. Meyer's testimony, it was actually testimony that he had provided before. It was duplicative. And as a matter of fact, when you had the hearings and the motion...
It was what?
It was duplicative.
But he didn't testify.
Right. But the information that
Mr.
Meyer...
But that what you said, it wasn't in evidence.
It wasn't in evidence, but it was in the record. He had testified previously in 1996. On the motion for modification, LSG had the opportunity, if it chose to do so, to submit Mr. Meyer's testimony, the exhibit that was already there, or to provide an affidavit. They were not restricted as to what they could do with respect to Mr. Meyer, but they did not do anything with respect to Mr. Meyer except to quote in its briefings previous testimony of Mr. Meyer in 1996. That's in their briefings. So the substance of what Mr. Myers was going to testify to was before the LUC. And beyond all of that, what Mr. Myers had to testify to, based upon Exhibit 6, his report, his testimony, it had nothing to do as to what potable meant. It wouldn't have helped the LUC.
You know, we get statutes and rules all the time. We're asked to interpret, and we interpret them, and they're not always clear on their face. We don't change the statute. We don't change the rule. You know, why couldn't the commission just interpret in its own findings and conclusions without going back and changing the condition?
Because the Supreme Court also said that the LUC has to say with ascertainable certainty what the parameters are of the conditions that it imposes. If they're just interpreting it without actually saying this is what it is, you are left as the petitioner without knowing what the guidance, what the conditions are, which is part of the dilemma in this case. It's unclear, it's vague. The LUC took the rightful course in saying, look, it's not clear. We're gonna make it clear. We're gonna not only say what qualitatively it should be, but quantitative it should be, so that there is proper guidance for everyone, or else we're guessing. Everyone is still guessing now. We're 25 years down the line, and there's no clarity. So,
yes. That's the part that's kind of confusing me. I mean, as far back as 1996, when the PUC issued its order, it had a number of findings, conclusions, call them what you will, about what potable meant. And so I'm a little bit confused about what was so unclear about it 25 years later.
It was unclear. There were inconsistent. The findings that were made with respect to it's brackish here, it's potable there, which standard do we use? It's unclear. The Supreme Court also found that it was unclear.
I thought that the commission used the federal standard, or were referring, or had at least had the federal standards in mind when Condition 10 was originally imposed.
But if you go back and look at the record, it's both. It talks about brackish. They use potable and brackish interchangeably. How is brackish defined? It wasn't clear. What's in the high-level aquifer? So different people were looking at it for different standards. It simply was not clear. And it was an attempt to clarify what is meant by those standards with ascertainable certainty. And that's the dilemma. The Supreme Court vacated the cease and desist order from 1996 because it wasn't unclear. Because if you look at it and you read it, what they're saying is you can't use all water or any water from the high-level aquifer. Where the Supreme Court said, well, that's not clear. So what we're trying to do is get clarity here.
So Ms. Farm, why did you wait until, or why did your client, not you personally, wait until after the Supreme Court's mandate to seek to modify, if that was the only way to get clarity over all these years? I mean, because to me, that's, you know, whether the modification can stand on its own is critical to what this court does. Why didn't they seek to modify 10 years earlier if that was the solution?
Well, the matter was up on appeal for quite some time.
Okay, so the Supreme Court's mandate was necessary for the modification.
Well, the LUC didn't have jurisdiction at that point. It had gone up. It was before the Circuit Court and then before the Supreme Court.
So they couldn't have sought, so you're saying they could not have petitioned for a modification of the condition?
I would have thought, I don't know the answer to that question, quite frankly. I would think that the LUC has the ability, it's not prohibited from doing what it needs to do. But that doesn't mean that because it didn't do it earlier, that it couldn't do it once the Supreme Court remanded the case down back to the LUC.
Unless, as Judge Foley posits, that in the procedural posture of this case, it was outside the Supreme Court's mandate.
Unless Judge Foley is correct. However, In all due respect, Your Honor, I don't believe that the LUC was confined by what the Supreme Court said on remand.
They were confined, let me give you that. You're just saying within the mandate, they have this room to do
right. Right, they have the ability to do that. What else could they do? They would be sitting there, they would be guessing. There needs to be some sort of finality.
Well, I'm pretty sure Mr. Copper will argue they could have let LSG put on its witnesses.
I'm sure that Mr. Copper will argue that, and he has argued that, and that seems to be the crux of it, as to whether or not, was the LUC at that point supposed to open up the hearings again? Mr. Copper's client could have provided the witness on the motion to modify. They could have done that. And they didn't do that. They chose not to do that. However, at the hearings on January 8, 2010, there was public testimony, there was oral argument. Mr. Murakami, who is sitting in the audience today, was there. Mr. Gima of LSG was there. Mr. Murakami basically put forth the position that Mr. Meyer had. And Mr. Gima of LSG put forth LSG's position.
In terms of procedural posture, I mean, it's, you know, the horse has left the barn, but conclude the contested case hearing. Conclude it. Make your findings and conclusions. Say, we don't know what it means. And then let the Nye Resorts make its motion. You know, when the contested case hearing is concluded, when you've complied with the mandate of the state Supreme Court, why not do it that way?
Well, they could have done it that way. The point is, it's not a violation of due process in the way that it did. And this is a case that's distinguishable from Monica, and I'm sure that all of you can.
Well, I think the due process comes in excluding, you know, Lanines versus Sensible Growth's ability to submit evidence. I think the other issue is whether or not it's within the mandate. That's not a due process.
That's
issue, it's whether or not it's within
correct.
The mandate.
Correct. That's not a due process issue. It's within the scope and the abilities of the LUC to do that. Before my time runs out, I'd also like to raise the fact that LSG doesn't have standing to bring this appeal. And it doesn't have standing because it is not the same entity that started the process to begin with. What you have is the original LSG was dissolved in 2005 for non-payment. It's an administrative dissolution. And what you have is the new LSG, which is a different entity, albeit it has a very similar name, that came into being in 2008. There was no substitution that was submitted as to the parties. What LSG would have you believe is that it's a successor. It's not a successor. If you want to afford yourself of the protections and the opportunities of the statute, then you need to abide by the rules of the statute.
Just to refresh my recollection, was the issue of standing raised before the Land Use Commission or the Circuit Court?
It was raised before the Circuit Court. Yes, it was raised before the Circuit Court. There was a motion to dismiss stating that LSG could not file the appeal from the LUC.
And what about the applicability of Hawaii Revised Statutes 14B-425B in terms of a dissolved corporation able to continue with a proceeding that was ongoing?
Well, what you have is, yes, it may continue the proceedings. The point is that at some point the old LSG stopped and a new LSG came in and took that place. So it's not as though they're winding up. The old LSG is not winding up anymore. It stopped. The new LSG came in 2008 and then did the appeal. Therefore, they didn't have standing to do that. And there was no motion for substitution filed pursuant to the Administrative Rules 15-1571. It simply was not done. So the Circuit Court erred when it did not grant that motion to dismiss. And we would ask on a separate grounds that this court grant that motion to dismiss.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if you folks have any other questions that we like me to answer prior to me proceeding, because I'd be happy to answer the questions, because knowing that you were going to rule on this without oral argument, I feel that, you know, there are certain things that you may want to...
I've asked my questions. I think you reserved 5 minutes
yes,
for a vote.
Yes, I did.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Copper.
This appeal really is only about procedure and due process, the right to be heard in a contested case before a decision is made. And that just did not happen here. In the contested case hearing below, the Land Use Commission denied Lanai's for Sensible Growth, who was a party to the contested case, the opportunity to call its witnesses. Your Honors, they just cut us off, but not before allowing the resort, the State Office of Planning, and the County of Maui the opportunity to present all of their witnesses, especially expert witness testimony.
Mr. Copper, assuming that we agree with that, that was in error, how does that necessarily require us to strike down the modification order?
That's a great point, Your Honor, and it is one of the 3 points I would like to make today, and I'll focus on that. Assuming that their motion for modification was made in the same proceedings, okay, and really regardless, a full contested case hearing is required before a condition of a boundary amendment can be modified. And we can just start with the rules. 15-1594 of Hawaii Administrative Rules, by incorporating subchapter 11 of the same, necessarily requires that a hearing which complies with the contested case hearing requirements in subchapter 7 be held before a modification can occur. So let's assume that, okay, this motion for modification really did take place in the show cause proceeding. Well, we know that the contested case hearing was not full because we were not allowed to present witness testimony. If it was a complete...
So let me just make sure I understand that. So it, on their motion for modification, you were not allowed to present evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. It was clearly filed in this contested case. And up until the day, which was January 25th, 2010, that the Land Use Commission granted the motion to modification, LSG requested the opportunity to present witness testimony.
And on the modification issue?
In the brief, yes, Your Honor, in the briefing regarding the motion for modification, we asserted that we need the opportunity, pursuant to due process, to call our witnesses. And that just did not happen. And again, if this was a separate proceeding, which Your Honor suggested that maybe that could have happened while the Supreme Court remand was going on, again, there needs to be a contested case hearing pursuant to the rules. And that just did not happen. Another reason, and I think Judge Foley talked about this, is, well, what about the effect of the Supreme Court's order? I think that Supreme Court's order makes modification not necessary because they found Condition 10 clear and enforceable. They define Condition 10. It means that Lanai Resorts cannot irrigate their golf course using potable water from the high-level aquifer. But what does potable mean? They define it in footnote 8 as meaning water suitable for drinking. And in fact, there was no standards at the time that the Land Use Commission modified Condition 10, whether it be county, state, or federal, which relied on chlorides or salinity to determine potability. And to say that the Land Use Commission, in fact, by their modification, clarified Condition 10, really is not true. They wrote potability completely out of that condition. They did not clarify what potable meant. They implemented an entirely new standard, a standard which really makes no sense given the, at the time, what was current county, state, and federal standards for drinking water.
But I do think that it's helpful to you to focus on process rather than the substance of the modified condition.
And you're right, Your Honor, because this case really is a matter of procedure and due process. And the second point that I would like to make today is really that the commission violated due process by not allowing LSG to call its witnesses.
Which were the witnesses, other than Mr. Meyer, that you wanted to put on but were precluded from doing so?
Well, we were precluded from calling any witnesses in our case in chief. And at page 5832 of the record is our list of witnesses, members of LSG, as well as a witness from the planning director from the county of Maui. It is true that some of the LSG members were able to provide public testimony, but we were not allowed to call any witnesses to conduct a direct examination in our case in chief. But really, the testimony of Mr. Meyer was particularly relevant and material to the issues before the commission on the contested case hearing. And it was so for three reasons. First, he was to testify as to the relevant issues on remand, namely that the resort was using potable water to irrigate their golf course at Manelli. And his testimony would have also provided a comment as to the wisdom of modifying condition 10 to remove potability completely out of that condition. Second.
Okay, so on that point, just because I want to make sure I'm really understanding this when I go back and reread this. So when they moved for modification, you said we want to put Meyer's testimony in to oppose modification.
Yes, Your Honor. We did object to the modification without having our full day in court or contested case here. And I can provide you with a specific site. I believe this is volume 24 on the record, page 4319. It's our opposition to the resort's modification motion of condition 10, specifically, and also on the record at 4453, we noted our objections to the same.
Thank you.
We did also object in a subsequent submission, which is at page 4450 of the record, and I believe specifically 4452 of that same document, and that was a subsequent submission regarding the authority to modify. So again, Mr. Meyer's testimony, in addition to being relevant to the Supreme Court's remand, would have been useful to the land use commission because they elected, as Judge Foley pointed out, they elected to hold a new contested case hearing. This was a commission made up of entirely new commission members from the prior contested case hearing procedures. And Ms. Farm is correct. Both parties did move for an adjudication of this matter pursuant to the Supreme Court remand without further hearings, because that was one of the options given by the Supreme Court in their 2004 decision. But the Land Use Commission themselves, at their May 18, 2006 commission meeting, elected to hold a contested case because they wanted to hear live testimony, new information. Well, Mr. Meyer had new hydrological information, which was updated in over 12 years since he last testified before the Land Use Commission. And this information would have been relevant as to the effect of the pumping of water by the resort to water their golf course of the high-level aquifer. And finally, HRS 91-10 mandates that every party to a contested case hearing has opportunity to present rebuttal evidence. That opportunity was not given. Now, the resort was able to call their expert, Tom Evans. He testified over the course of 2 days before the commission. And he testified as to these issues, whether the resort was violating condition 10, what was the effects of long-term pumping. And the error of the commission in not allowing us to rebut this testimony is actual error, because the resort was able to rely on this testimony when they moved for modification. Their 2007 motion at page on the record 4107 relies on this expanded record. It relies on the 2006 testimony of Tom Evans. So to say that, well, the Alliance for Sensible Growth, you guys can just rely on what Mr. Meyer said in the 1990s. Well, there's over a decade of information which we were not allowed to provide and expand on in the record. And we also were not allowed to directly rebut the testimony of Mr. Nance, who was allowed to testify over the course of 2 days. Ms. Farb did recognize, I think it deserves pointing out, that we attempted to submit the testimony of Mr. Meyer as our Exhibit 17 in this 2016 testing case hearing. And at the June 7th meeting, it was expressly rejected by the commission. So whether it is on the record or not, it was ultimately never received into evidence.
Could you address the standing issue, her last point, the standing of Lanayans for Sensible Growth to file their appeal with the State Circuit Court?
Yes, Your Honor. That argument really is of no effect for three reasons. We should note that dissolution of Lanayans for Sensible Growth really was temporary, 2004 to 2008. Dissolution has no effect on ongoing litigation pursuant to their own authority, 245B. Even administrative dissolution, under Section 249, which is an argument made by the resort in their briefs, specifically incorporates Section 245, which again states that dissolution has no effect on ongoing proceedings. Second, a dissolved corporation nonetheless can wind up their affairs. That's again under 245. And this litigation, these administrative proceedings, have been ongoing since the petition was filed in 89. And LSG predates that matter. So this is indeed an affair.
Right, but I think her argument is that this isn't winding up, that there's a new Lanayans for Sensible Growth. It's not the same entity.
I would respectfully disagree that this is the same entity. It reincorporated in 2008 as Lanayans for Sensible Growth. The name change occurred after that, in 2010, subsequent to the appeal. But it was simply a name change. So this this matter was before the Land Use Commission. At that time, they're under the same name. It was the same officers. This was the same organization. And it was nothing more than a name change filed with the DCC in 2010. And finally, let's just say that that is true, that for whatever reason, LSG, the original LSG, has been dissolved. Well, it's the same members. And an unincorporated nonprofit association can participate in administrative and judicial proceedings. And this is under case law as well as a statute, which authorizes.
Would they have been, assuming that was the case, would they have been required to substitute in as parties as an unincorporated association, as Ms. Farm suggested?
I don't believe so here, Your Honor. I mean, I haven't seen an authority which suggests the same. And this is a situation where it really is the same organization, the same members, and any judgment against or for LSG is completely enforceable against a successor. And we're talking about just a matter of formality here, and to preclude a community organization such as LSG, which really does represent the interests of Lanai. And I think it should be noted that back in 1991, really 1990 when the Lanai...
Mr. Copper, I don't think... again, this is one of those technicalities that courts have to wrestle with, which is, it isn't whether they really represent the interests of the people. We get that. But the question is, in order to continue with a court proceeding, you know, if I died and my next of kin wanted to continue with a case that I had, they would have to substitute in as parties, even though their interests would be perfectly aligned. Is there any authority for us to overlook that procedure?
Your Honor, I would think that that assumes that this is a different organization. And again, this is simply just a name change.
Okay. Thank you.
I would like to briefly address our argument, which was brief before this court, as to the rightness of this appeal. Again, what we have is the circuit court remanding this matter back to the Land Use Commission for further de novo proceedings which comply with due process. And that's where we should be. And there's law that that supports this proposition that we are unable to sue. 641-1, of course, Jenkins versus Kate Shuddy, requires that appeals be had from final orders. And in the administrative context, the Supreme Court says that a final order is an order ending proceedings, leaving nothing further to be accomplished. And consequently, an order is not final if the rights of the parties remain undetermined. And of course, the rights of the parties here are undetermined because the Circuit Court vacated the Land Use Commission's order, remanded this for further de novo proceedings.
There was nothing further to be accomplished in the Circuit Court, isn't that correct?
That is true, Your Honor. But I looked at cases of both this court and the Supreme Court in analogous situations, which suggests that this remand order indeed is not the final. So we have Mitchell versus State, Williams versus Clean Co. Williams is a case of this court. Both of those cases involve remand orders of the Labor Industrial Relations Appeals Board. It was an administrative remand, but nonetheless follows the same logic that you have not ended the proceedings below, so it is not a final order. Now, in this exact same context, a remand order from a circuit court in the Chapter 91 appeal, we have Jordan versus Hamada. And that court, the Supreme Court in that case recognized that when a circuit court remands a matter back to the agency for further determinations, it does not end the case even within the circuit court. Notwithstanding, there has been a final judgment, and we cite the federal case law to that effect. The effect of the remand is to keep the proceedings alive. And that's what Jordan versus Hamada recognized.
Well, if we were to affirm Judge Sakamoto, then proceedings before the Land Use Commission would continue, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And if we were to reverse Judge Sakamoto, the proceedings before the Land Use Commission would be over, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. It sounds right to me.
If there are no further questions, I'd just like to refocus us.
Okay. Thank you, Counselor.
If I may, just in closing.
Yes.
Despite Judge Leonard's caution, I do want to sort of remind us, and there's authority to do this, of what's really at stake here. We do have a resort, irrigating golf course, using the only source of drinking water for the whole island. And the Land Use Commission is supposed to consider this when they make their decisions. And this is to say that when you have a party to a contested case, in a case of such importance, I mean, really it should be a case of any importance, but especially one is this, that party has a right to be heard. We have this public trust resource which demands it, but really we have the law, Mauna Kea Naiho, which says that you have to develop the record before you render a decision. Chapter 91.9, 91.10, the Land Use Commission's rules regarding contested case hearings for modification orders, and just principles of fairness all require that a party such as Alliance for Sensible Growth have the opportunity to be heard before the rights are adjudicated, before a decision is made in a contested case. And there really can be no dispute that that did not happen here. We did not have the same opportunity as the resort to present our witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Copper. That's fine.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Farmer, I want to try and avoid interrupting you because you only have 5 minutes, so I want to tell you what I'm listening for in particular. One of the things Mr. Copper said was that a full contested case hearing must be allowed before a modification can occur. And another thing that he said was that the motion for modification relied on Mr. Nance's testimony. And so I'm listening for you to address those 2 points.
Okay. I'm shorter, Mr. Copper. Let me address those 2 points. With respect to the contested case hearing, you can't have it both ways. You can't say that this entire thing is a contested case hearing, but when you do the motion to modify, you're starting a new contested case hearing. What you have is you need to look at it in a whole as to what was presented. Now, the motion for modification is just like in trial. When you get to a certain point, you can file your dispositive motions. You can go ahead and take a separate tack. The LUC has the ability to do that. There is nothing that precludes them from doing that. Yes, when you do a motion for modification, you have to look at Chapter 11. I agree with Mr. Copper in that respect. The rules provide for that. But if you're going to look at Chapter 11 and you look at the entire contested case, look at the entire record. You look at Mr. Nance, you look at, and if I may, on one of their oppositions on their motion for modification, and this is one that they filed on December 23rd, 2009, in opposition to the State of Hawaii Office of Planning. They had filed one previously against Lanai's for Sensible Growth. They actually cite to the testimony of Bill Meyer. They rely upon Bill Meyer. So you have the evidence with respect to what Mr. Meyer was going to testify to before them in the record. It's not as though what he was going to be presenting is not there before the court, before the LUC. It is there. They did, in fact, say, really, you should continue with the contested case hearings. They did say that in the motions to modify, but they did nothing with respect to attempting to provide more information with respect to Mr. Meyer. They did nothing with respect to that. They had full opportunity to be heard. They had notice, full opportunity to be heard. There was no due process violation. And if you step back, and I sat in on the previous hearing, due process is due process for all. I believe one of the attorneys said that. And that is the case here. What about due process for Lanai Resorts? What about clarity in its condition 10? And to jump to that, I want to say, look at footnote 8 in the Supreme Court's decision. Because the footnote 8 talks about, well, one side says this, one side says that. It is unclear. It's not clear. That's part of the problem. And here on the motion to modify, what was happening is that they're trying to get clarity so that there is ascertainable certainty. The doing of the motion to modify was proper, was totally within their purview. It was not limited by the scope of the remand. They have the ability to do that. And again, and I know I said this earlier, at the hearing on January 8th, there was an opportunity for witnesses. LSG testified. Mr. Murakami, on behalf of LSG as their counsel, did a presentation about the very information that Mr. Meyer was going to present and testimony. If anyone is denied due process, it's really in the line of sorts for not being able to cross-examine Mr. Meyer on his testimony.
It's pretty hard to cross-examine someone who hasn't testified.
That's true, but that way only Mr. Meyer's testimony is gotten in through other sources. And I do want to answer the question with respect to the substitution. Again, this is a different entity. You don't automatically become a successor because you have the same interest. And there are rules with respect to that. Let me find it. It's 15-1571, substitution of parties.
Which rule?
Hawaii Administrative Rules, 15-1571. So it wasn't as though this was just a temporary situation. And with respect to finality, and I won't go over this if there is a sense that this is ripe. There is a final judgment, the Pash case.
I think it's ripe.
Okay, thank you. All right. Sorry, I'm trying to cross off all of them.
Okay, thank you. You have anything further? I think your time is up.
Well, thank you very much, and we would ask that the court reverse the Circuit Court and affirm the LUC's order vacating the 1996 cease and desist order and granting the motion for modification. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. Take the matter under advisement.
All right.